Welcome to the 100th episode of What It Takes. So a very special thanks for listening. And it's a great moment to spread the word too, because this week we are going presidential with Jimmy Carter.
People ask me, how did you stand the long campaigning? How did you stand being, you know, charged with the responsibilities of a great nation and one of the most powerful and difficult jobs in the world? It wasn't any more difficult than picking cotton all day or shaking peanuts. There's an equality there. If you have a task to perform and are vitally interested in it, excited and challenged by it, then you will exert, you know, maximum energy. But in the excitement, the pain of fatigue dissipates. An exuberance of what you hope to achieve overcomes the reluctance to be weary.
That excerpt is from a 1991 interview with Jimmy Carter, the first of three he's done for the Academy of Achievement. Back then, he showed no signs of weariness in his efforts to promote peace and human rights at home and around the world. Now, at 94 and a half years old, he still shows no signs. The 39th President of the United States, on a mission and going strong, on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Jimmy Carter broke a new record in March of 2019. He became the longest living president in U.S. history. 2 weeks before crossing that milestone, he and journalist Mary Jordan sat down in Plains, Georgia, to record a conversation for the Academy of Achievement. Mary had started her interview with President Carter in 2017, but the problem is there's so much ground to cover when you're talking to Jimmy Carter, it's impossible to fit it all in a single sitting. His story is so rich, so improbable, and so, well, long. It starts, of course, in Plains, where Carter was born in 1924 and still lives with Rosalyn, his wife of almost 73 years.
When she was born, I was 3 years old, and I lived next door to her. So when she was, I guess, 1 day old, I went over to look at her. My mother was a registered nurse and kind of helped take care of her mother when she had a baby. So I looked at Rosalyn when she was, you know, 1 day old, I guess.
How'd she look?
She looked like a baby. I didn't pay any attention to her then.
The romance didn't begin for another, 15 years or so, when they rode together to the movies in the rumble seat of his friend's Ford coupe. He told his mother that night that Rosalyn was the woman he'd marry, and he did in 1946. It's an idyllic story, but the Plains, Georgia they grew up in the 1930s and 40s, Carter told Mary Jordan, was far from idyllic.
When you grew up here, black people couldn't even come in the front door of places. You write...
That's true.
You write in one of your many books, An Hour Before Daylight, about how they're still coming in the back door of white families' homes. They're riding in separate parts of the passenger train. They have to sit upstairs in the America's Movie Theater and in the courthouses and attend separate schools and churches. That was what you grew up in.
And that was the law of the land. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court upheld. That's what the Congress approved. And so far as I know, nobody even in the American Bar Association spoke out against it. It was accepted pretty well all over the nation, as well as in the South, of course.
But, Jimmy Carter said, when he was growing up, his own neighbors and playmates were African American. So he wasn't tuned into racial discrimination, even though his father was a segregationist. And there was his mother's influence, which he described to journalist Jim Angle in the earlier 1991 interview for the Academy.
My father, although admirable in many ways, measured by modern-day standards, would have been looked upon as very conservative on the race issue, which was a way of life in Georgia then. Mother never paid any attention to that. We lived in a remote area outside of Plains, a little community called Archery. And it was during the Depression years. Mother, being a registered nurse, acted almost as a medical doctor for the poor families around Archery. They would come to my mother, and she also did nursing duties in the hospital nearby. But she would help them with childbirth or with other illnesses without any charge. And I could see that my mother broke down the barriers of race discrimination. I think that made more of an impression on me. My daddy was a very dominant person in the family, but in the relationship between mother and our black neighbors, which was quite startling for the Plains community of those days, my father could not dominate my mother. And I think that was kind of an inspirational aspect of life that was very memorable.
He soaked in his mother's example, but Jimmy Carter told Mary Jordan that he first developed a conscious understanding of what was going on around him when he became a young teenager.
It was when I was 14 years old, I wrote a poem about this later on, that I was going with two African-American playmates of mine through a gate on the way from the pasture to the barn. And when we got to the gate, they stopped to let me go first. And I thought they had a tripwire or something there that I was going to fall down. But I realized a lot later that their parents had probably told them that since we had reached that age of young teenage, that it was time for them to start deferring to me as a white person, and they were black. And that was kind of drew a line between African-Americans and white people and between friends like me and my African-American neighbors. So that was the first time I really realized it was when I was about 14 years old.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, about that time, I was also being more deeply involved with white people in church and in school. I didn't have driver's licenses then. I was getting my daddy's pickup truck and going to prom parties and so forth. So it was time for me to shift, I say, from an African-American environment, all of my neighbors were African-Americans, to more of a white culture. And I didn't really see the impact of racial equality until I was in the Navy later on, and Harry Truman was president, and he ordained as commander-in-chief that the time for racial discrimination was over in all the military and the civil service, in the Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard. And I was very deeply involved in that as a member of a crew of a submarine. And so I felt quite relieved to realize that the racial discrimination would no longer be a millstone around the neck of black people who suffered from it. And also, it had been a millstone around the necks of white people as well.
When Carter was elected governor of Georgia, his face was featured on the cover of Time magazine. It was 1971. Most Americans had never heard of him until then, but his was the face of the New South, an anti-racist white man, a liberal. The cover story title read, "Dixie Whistles a Different Tune." 6 years later, he'd be the 39th president of the United States. But that wasn't supposed to be in the stars.
So as we sit here in Plains, and you're 94.
That's right. Soon be 95.
When you look back, what would you say? Can we talk about one of the turning points in your life? What was a moment, really, when things could have gone one way or another?
Well, when I was 6 years old, if you had asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, I would have said, I want to go to Annapolis and be a naval officer. And that's all I wanted to do. And my mother and father knew it, and my teachers in school knew it. All my classmates knew that's what I wanted to do. And so I was successful finally in getting into the Naval Academy. And I never intended to leave the Navy until I was finished my full career. But then 12 years later, my father died unexpectedly. He had pancreatic cancer. And so I came home to be with him on his, well, we all knew he was going to die. And I saw that my father's life was very meaningful to Plains and to the community around here, to the farmers who traded with him. He had a warehouse business. And so on the way back to Schenectady in New York, where I was on the second atomic submarine, I decided I would get out of the Navy. And it was a surprise to me and a horrible surprise to Rosa when I told her my decision. And so she was very angry about it. She didn't want to get out of the Navy, come back home, where she felt she would be dominated by her mother and my mother. And we didn't have any money. I was kind of the boss then, which I'm not now. And so we just got out of the Navy despite her strong opposition. And we stayed in the government housing project. We didn't have any money. At the first year, our total income the whole year was $280. And so I couldn't get a loan the second year. And so we continued struggling with farming. I was a full-time farmer for 17 years.
So if your father had not been sick and died, you would have, what do you think would have happened?
I would have stayed in the Navy, and I think I would. I was on a very fast track to being a successful naval officer.
You'd probably be running the Navy. You could.
I think I would have been an admiral. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I may have gotten involved in the political side of the Navy, you know. But a lot later, I think 17 years later, I finally ran for office. And I was chairman of the local school board, and I was trying to prevent closing down the public school system because the key Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia said no, not one, which meant to all of his followers that if one black child entered a white classroom, he would close down the public school system.
Between their return to Plains and that run for the Georgia State Senate, there were some very tough years for Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter.
What was it like to come back from the Navy back to the segregated South?
It was difficult for me and Rosalynn. And there were five people in Sumter County who felt the same way we did, five couples.
Five couples out of how many?
Well, there are about 30,000 people who live in the county. Well, the owner of the only radio station in America was run out of town. And the president of Georgia Southwestern College was run out of town. And the county attorney was run out of town. But I survived because I presumed, in looking back on it afterward, because my family was very distinguished. We'd lived here since the early 1800s. We were highly respected and that sort of thing. My daddy was highly respected. So I think because my roots were deep in Sumter County, we were permitted to stay. But I contemplated, after a while, going back into the nuclear submarine program. And I had several offers of a very good job then because I had a special knowledge that was not very common in those days. But I eventually decided to stay at home.
There was a knock at your door in 1954. That was the same year as Brown versus Board. And the police chief and a Baptist minister asked you, why not join the White Citizens Council?
Yeah. They told me that every man in Plains had joined it except me. I didn't think it was the right thing to do, so I refused. And I told them quite harshly that it only cost $5. They said they would pay the dues for me. And I said, well, I'll take $5 back and flush it down the toilet, but I'm not joining the White Citizens Council. By then, my family and I had already been pretty well ostracized. I remember the first indication I had of that was I stopped at the only service station in Plains, and they refused to put gasoline in my pickup truck. And so we had boycotts organized against our business, but we survived eventually.
What was the point of the White Citizens Council that you refused to join?
I felt it was a descendant of the Ku Klux Klan, although they were not violent like the Klan was. And it was just a symbol of racial superiority and animosity. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I think I got that more in the Navy than I did living on a farm before I went into the Navy. And I think I inherited that maybe from my admiration for Harry Truman, who I still consider to be the best president that served in my lifetime.
Why? What did you love about Harry Truman?
I thought he was simple, down to earth, completely honest and truthful, and he was very courageous in that decision he made about eliminating racial discrimination in the military forces, which was very unpopular then. And he was despised in 1948 when he ran for president. And Thomas Dewey was running against him. And I was in submarine school then in New London, Connecticut. And there were 51 officers in that school. I was the only one for Harry Truman. And I remember that I couldn't find any other officers the day after the election was over. I was trying to gloat over Truman's victory, but I couldn't find anybody else. So, you know, I was a great admirer of Harry Truman.
Well, go back to this.
Sure.
Taking a stand when you were young. You had no idea at that point that you'd
No.
be the president of the United States.
Of course.
And
not.
You took economic threats. You know, people are boycotting your peanut farm. What do you tell young people when they're in a difficult situation, a lot of pressure to kind of conform? What would you tell them?
You know, I really quite often quote my high school principal superintendent, whose name was Miss Julia Coleman. In fact, I quoted her when I was inaugurated president, and I quoted her later on when I got the Nobel Peace Prize. And she used to tell us young people, we must accommodate changing times, but cling to principles that never change. And I felt that the equality of human beings, you know, in the eyes of God, was a principle that would never change. And I realized that even more fully, I'd say, after I became a submarine officer.
Carter's run for that Georgia State Senate seat in 1963 was hard won, and no one knows that better than his wife. Here's a clip of Rosalynn Carter telling the story at an Academy of Achievement summit in 1984. The audio quality is a little rocky, but the quiet charm that made her a beloved first lady shines right through.
One interesting thing I think you might like to hear was about Jimmy's first venture into politics, because that was, I think, the worst period of my life. He ran for the state Senate, and we had a 7-county district. And there was one county that held out all of its ballots until the total vote came in. We were a few votes. We were ahead. They put in enough ballots in the box to defeat us. And Jimmy contested the election. When the ballot box was found, it was under the bed of the daughter of the man who had been responsible for stuffing the ballot box. Jimmy went into that county every day to collect affidavits. I was running the peanut warehouse. When he crossed the county line, he would have somebody behind him telling him. I was scared to death. He had threats on his life. Somebody came to the peanut warehouse one day and told me that the last time anybody had crossed this man, their businesses had burned down. I was afraid to go home. I was afraid the house was going to be burned down, the businesses burned down. It was at the same time of the racial integration and all of that crises at home. You might like to know that when the ballot box was open, there were no stubs. The first 75 people had voted alphabetically.
Jimmy Carter successfully challenged that blatant voter fraud and took his seat in the Georgia Senate and on the Education Committee, determined to save the public schools and universities from being shut down by segregationists. A few years later, in 1966, he ran for governor and lost miserably in the Democratic primary. The civil rights movement had led to a backlash. The guy who did win that year was Lester Maddox, a restaurant owner who barred blacks from his business and passed out axe handles to white patrons to show their defiance of the Civil Rights Act. Carter didn't have a chance.
It was the first real defeat in my life. Everything else, I'd been successful. Whenever I wanted something in the Navy, I got it because I was an outstanding officer. I worked hard and so did my work. And then that was a very serious blow to me. I was very distressed. And my sister, whose name is Ruth Stapleton, was a famous evangelist. She wrote 4 or 5 books, and she would give lectures to 50,000 people at the time. And she and I had a long walk in the woods on my farm. And she said, Jimmy, quite often when you have a blow to your pride and a horrible defeat, you can either give up or you can look on it as a way that God opens to you to do different and even better things. And I said, Ruth, I've been defeated for governor in Georgia. My political career is over. I don't have any future. But it proved to be wrong.
Indeed. 4 years later, he ran again on a more conservative platform and won. His inauguration speech came as a bit of a surprise to some of his supporters.
At the end of a long campaign, I believe I know our people of this state as well as anyone could. Based on this knowledge of Georgians, North and South, rural and urban, liberal and conservative, I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over.
And it wasn't long after that Jimmy Carter made that cover of Time magazine and became a national figure. A couple of years later, when the one-term governor from the Deep South with no Washington experience said he was running for president, the pundits scoffed. But the born-again Christian peanut farmer from Plains knew something the experts didn't. Americans were eager to embrace a fresh, untainted leader who could bridge the chasm of mistrust that had opened between the people and their government after the twin disasters of Vietnam and Watergate. Here's a bit from one of Carter's campaign ads in 1976.
I see an America on the move again, united, its wounds healed, an America entering its third century with confidence and competence and compassion, an America that lives up to the majesty of its Constitution and the simple decency of its people. This is my vision of America. I hope you share it, and I hope you will help me fight for it.
Carter was a sincere, unpretentious, optimistic moderate and a workhorse. He managed to beat out 9 other Democratic challengers for the nomination. And then he beat the sitting president, Gerald Ford, who hadn't been elected in the first place and whose pardon of Nixon did not sit well with a lot of Americans. During his campaign, Carter also got a boost from an unusual source. It's a little hard to fathom while you're listening to this 94-year-old elder statesman, but...
They call you the rock and roll president. You were one of the first, actually, right, who used music on the campaign trail.
Not just on the campaign trail, but I was immersed in music from the very beginning. But when I ran for president, I didn't have any cash money. And they had a matching program then, which may still be intact. And so the Allman Brothers, particularly, just kind of adopted me as a candidate. And they would come to New York State and to New Hampshire and so forth, and they would put on, and in the South too, and they would put on a concert, and they would charge $15 for everybody that came in, which they gave to me. The $15 went to me, not to them. And then when we put in a claim to the federal government under the rules then, the federal government would match the $15. So I got $30 every time anybody came to hear the Allman Brothers, who were quite popular then. We did that with other musicians as well. during the campaign. But I have been very close to a lot of musical performers, particularly, you know, country music and popular music.
Bob Dylan?
Bob Dylan, yes. Bob Dylan's been a friend of mine since I first met him. Bob Dylan came and performed in Atlanta, Georgia, when I was governor. And strangely enough, he came to the governor's mansion after his concert, he and his band. My three sons were avid Bob Dylan fans, so they stayed in the governor's mansion with their band members. And Bob Dylan said he wanted to talk to me privately. So we went out in the garden and talked for an hour or two. And I realized later that that was when he was considering about his basic religion. He was considering becoming a Christian.
What did you talk about for 2 hours?
He asked me mostly, if I remember correctly, it's a little long time ago, just why I was a Christian and how my daily life interrelated with religion and so forth, things like that. And I didn't know until later that he was considering. I didn't try to convert him to Christianity. I knew he was Jewish by birth and maybe by belief. But that was when we first got started, and after that, every time he's been in concert anywhere near enough, I've always been.
Pointed threats they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece. The hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying.
Jimmy Carter has often quoted Dylan, including during the 1976 Democratic Convention when he accepted his party's nomination for president.
I've never had more faith in America than I do today. We have an America that, in Bob Dylan's phrase, is busy being born, not busy dying.
Let's talk about your days in the White House. When you look back on those 4 years that you spent in Washington, are there certain moments when you think about the strain? What was the most stressful time?
Well, by far the most stressful time for me was the time when the Iranians were holding the hostages. And I was under tremendous pressure from even my own supporters to attack Iran militarily, to punish them for taking and holding our hostages. But I was resolved to do the best I could to get them home safe and free without a war. And I was successful in doing that eventually. But that was a terrible strain on me. And I was deeply concerned with each individual hostage. I knew every one of them by name. I knew and encouraged their families to come to Washington to meet with me. And so I would say maybe excessively personally involved in their family life and in their meeting their wives and their parents. And the failure of me to get them freed before election season came along was the number one factor, I think, in my being defeated for re-election.
What would you have done differently in handling that crisis?
Now looking back?
Right.
Nothing. I would not attack Iran militarily. If I had done it, I think one of the first things they would have done, understandably, would be to kill all the hostages. If I had killed several thousand Iranians with American bombs, then I think their normal reaction would have been to get rid of the hostages. So I think every hostage came home safe and free.
And that's the way it is. Tuesday, January 20th, 1981. A day that began as the 444th day of captivity and ended as the first day of freedom for the American hostages in Iran.
But going back earlier in Carter's White House tenure, his first order of business on day one was to grant amnesty to hundreds of thousands of young men who'd evaded the draft during the Vietnam War. Not long after, he created two new cabinet-level departments, education and energy, and he developed a national conservation policy to reduce America's reliance on imported oil. But he also pursued the deregulation of transportation, communication, and finance. This was before deregulation became a Republican calling card. He is today especially proud of establishing full diplomatic relations with China and with brokering the peace settlement between Israel and Egypt at Camp David. And then there was Panama.
The most satisfying moment that I had as president was when the Senate approved the Panama Canal Treaty. That had been a burning issue with me for a long time, and I saw it as a key not only to friendship with Latin American countries, but also as a key to democracy in this entire hemisphere. And the results of that decision by the U.S. Senate have far exceeded what I anticipated at the time. So that was the most exciting and gratifying success that I had.
You appointed more people of color, more women to the federal bench than all of the presidents before you.
That's true.
You appointed, in the end, Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the appellate court, so that she was positioned to move on to the Supreme Court. How does that feel to appoint these people who go on in their own way, make history?
Well, it was gratifying to me to see how well they did. Quite often, when we would suggest appointing a woman or an African American or Hispanic to the federal judgeship, it was highly opposed by some of the people in my own administration, and it was highly opposed by sometimes the representatives and other legislators from that state.
Why?
Well, it was just not the thing to do, and one of the reasons was that you had to have a recommendation from the American Bar Association as one of the chief elements of their high credentials. And the people that I chose, women and African Americans, never had a chance to be the dean of a law school or the head of a major law firm. They were relatively unknown, and so they were promoted above some of their male peers.
You're a hero to so many people in the civil rights movement because of the judges that you elected, for saying no to whites-only groups. How do you think things are now, as we sit here now? How do you think the state of race relations are in the United States?
Well, when I was elected president, I thought they had been resolved. You know, I grew up during a time when Martin Luther King Jr. and Andy Young and John Lewis and others bring about those changes, and Lyndon Johnson was a hero of mine when he declared an end to racial discrimination and equal rights to vote and so forth. So when I was elected president, that was not a major issue. It was assumed by me and many others, I think all over the country, to be over with. But there's been a retrogression, I think, toward these resegregated schools and a much more vivid, publicly known racism in our country.
What are you most worried about now, the direction of the country?
I think the sharp division among people. The blue versus red states never existed when I was in office, and the carryover hostility, a lack of cooperation in Washington among our legislators makes it almost impossible to pass any sort of controversial, even beneficial law. I think the massive influx of money into political campaigns has made our country more of an oligarchy than it is a true democracy. And I don't see the present prospects of these problems being corrected.
How would you fix the first problem? We're talking about the sharp divide, the red and the blue. How do you see that getting better?
Well, there's some inherent causes of it. One is the massive influx of money. The other one is the deliberate gerrymandering of congressional districts by both Democratic and Republican leaders when they get full control of a state government. Those two things could only be addressed by the Supreme Court. We just got to be patient and wait for that. But I think inherently the American people when they have been aware of an existing problem and have acknowledged that problem, we've always been able in the past to correct it. And so I think that that time's going to come in the future. I'm also a Christian, and I believe that the long-term goal that God has for us human beings is good.
There's growing concern about the Electoral College.
I know.
And what do you think? Is it time to put it to rest?
Even if I said yes, I would have to add it's almost totally impossible ever to get that changed in the U.S. Constitution, because every small state is going to resist strongly giving up the Electoral College because that gives them a much elevated influence in the presidential election. So the small states that only have two senators might have only one congressman, like Alaska or Hawaii.
But do you think it should be eliminated? Do you think the fair thing?
If I could just rewrite the Constitution the way I want it, without considering the difficulty of changing it, I would have each president serve one term, maybe 6 years or 5 years, like they do in almost every other country. And instead of having two terms.
Why?
I think that almost every president now, when he's been in office, say 2 years, is beginning to shape his policies and his public statements and so forth as a candidate for re-election. And if he knew he could serve for 6 years and no more, then I think he would go on maybe 4 or 5 of those years and just be doing things that he thought was not partisan, but just as a presidential responsibility.
I know you've been outspoken on Citizens United, so another reform, I imagine, is the money.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you do?
I think the United States has become an oligarchy instead of a democracy, because during the campaign and during the incumbency of successful candidates, there's a great pressure on them, almost impossible to withstand, to favor the rich people who can put a lot of money into a campaign or a re-election campaign. And so any change in the tax laws or any change in other laws concerning the justice system is heavily oriented against poor people and toward the rich people. The rich people get richer and richer. The poor people get relatively poorer and poorer. I would like to see public financing of campaigns, which it was when I was running for office. As a matter of fact, not in the primary, but when I ran against an incumbent president, neither he or I raised a single penny for a campaign against each other.
Do you think you could have been president in the current era where this limitless money can be thrown?
No.
So candidates who came, as you were, relatively unknown until your face appeared in Time magazine, almost impossible now to come out because of money.
I would think so, yeah. And now it's well known that you have to be able to raise, I would say, $200 million or so. I don't know the exact figure, just to be the nominee of a Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
With your hindsight, with your experience, what makes a great president?
I think basic character, and I would say that the best measurement of a character is whether you tell the truth or not. And that was one of the reasons I was elected, because before I was elected, there was a lot of misleading statements made, you know, during the Vietnam War and that sort of thing. I won't go into detail about that. But I promised to tell the truth when I was a candidate and when I was president. And I would tell even small groups at the beginning that if I ever make a misleading statement, don't vote for me. And suppose I know I went through my time in the White House and I never lied or misled the American people at all. Sometimes I wouldn't answer a question that a news person asked me if it was very sensitive, but when I made a statement, as far as I know, even now, it was the truth. I think that's the best measurement of a person's character.
How do you see this time we're in? A lot of people don't know what's true. What's true and what's not?
That's true. That's correct. People don't know what the truth is. I just have my own opinion about what is the truth, but when I have some evidence to back me up. But I don't think there's any belief now that the White House statements are truthful.
How do you think he's doing on North Korea? You have spent a lot of time.
That's one issue on which I'm very much in favor of what he's done and hope he will continue with that effort. I think that his National Security Advisor, John Bolton, is avidly against a step-by-step process. And he's always made that plain. And I think that there should be a step-by-step process where we and North Koreans spell out what we hope to be the ultimate goal and then have a 3 or 4 step process of getting there and let each side be satisfied with what the other group is doing before we make the next step.
This administration is not known for step-by-step. They like big dramatic moves.
That's true.
Do you think you could help them out there on that?
Well, even though I'm almost 95 years old, I would still be willing to go to North Korea to try to help if I could. But I think that's an extremely remote possibility.
That you'd be asked to me? Or
if I would be asked, yes.
Yeah. But why would you do it at 95? Why do you care so much?
Well, down through the last long time, since I went over there and met with Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of Kim Jong-un, I have been looked on by North Koreans as something of a hero because I was the last person who was a highly publicized friend of Kim Il-sung. And he and I worked out almost complete agreement on 12 controversial issues. And he died only about a month after I was over there. And I think that because of my credentials with Kim Il-sung, who's still a major hero in North Korea, I think that would give me an entree that might be beneficial, but I'm not pushing to go. I mean,
peace has been very elusive.
It has been.
Is it possible with North Korea?
Yes, it's possible. It's possible. I don't think there's any reason why we should still, 75 years later, I was on a submarine in the Pacific Ocean during the Korean War, and 75 years after that was over, we still don't have a peace agreement.
Can you talk about when you lost in 1980, yes, before you became the swashbuckling ex-president? Those were dark days, right? At first.
They were, but I survived it, I think, primarily because Rosa was so totally distressed, and I had to think up reasons to assuage her grief and her anger about the outcome of the 1980 election. So I was constantly trying to think in my mind, what are the good things about the future that I could share with my grieving wife? So I think that helped me get over it more easily than I would have done otherwise. And then having the hostages come home the day I went out of office was a great relief to me as well.
She was angry because it was unfair. She was angry. Why?
Well, she was angry at the winner. She was angry at the American people because of their poor judgment. And she was deeply regretted my not being, you know, honored by the American people as a continuation of my presidency.
You've talked about how you didn't want to use the office of the presidency to make money for yourself.
Right.
And you don't do the big speeches.
No, I never have been on a corporate board. I've made speeches sometimes and they give me an honorarium afterwards. And I generally, not always, but I generally give an honorarium to the Carter Center. Or sometimes I give it back to the, if it's a small college or something where I speak, and they send me a check for $10,000, quite often I just endorse it back to them.
Well, many other former presidents get, you know, $250,000 for speech, yeah, or more than that. Why did you decide?
I don't criticize them for that, by the way.
But why don't you do it?
I have tried to emulate Harry Truman, who was my favorite president during my lifetime. And I know that he refused to ever use his previous position in the White House for his own benefit. And I just kind of foolishly, after I was defeated and before I went out of office, I told the news people that I was going to adopt his policy, which I have adopted, and I've kind of stuck with it. But I have had a good income, and
you said foolishly. Do you think it was a mistake to say that?
Well, but it was binding on me, kind of, because I made a promise that I didn't want to break it. But and some of the older news reporters may have remembered it. But anyway, I said it, and I meant it. And I never have suffered because of it. I've had a very good income from my books. I've written 34 books, and they've all been, you know, reasonably successful. And I still get my retirement pay, having been president. And I teach full-time at Emory University, too. I'm a professor. I get a professor's salary, so I have a good income.
There is one interesting detail Carter is leaving out here. When he left the White House in 1980, defeated by Ronald Reagan, he discovered he was deeply in debt. He had put all his financial resources into a private trust when he became president, and he didn't allow the trust to communicate with him. When he was defeated for re-election, he learned that instead of being a fairly wealthy person, he was $1 million in the hole and thought he was going to have to sell off his farms. But he did manage to repay the debts from the sources he just mentioned, and he and Rosalind were able to keep the home in Plains where they returned from Washington.
You were only 56 years old when you left Washington.
Right. I was.
When people say, you know, Jimmy Carter was even the best ex-president we've ever had, the best former president, maybe even, you know, better than the president, what do you make of that?
Well, I realize that they're not including me among the best of presidents, but I don't object to that, particularly because I'm so proud of the life I've had as a post-president. I have some regrets on occasion about things that I believe I could have done if I had stayed in office for another 4 years. I think I could have taken care of the Israeli-Palestinian altercation, and that has dragged on now till it's almost gone to the worst shape. I think I could have embedded human rights more deeply in the consciousness of America and the value of maintaining peace. So there's some things that I regret not having been able to do, but I've had such a wonderful life after I left the White House that I haven't ever had any grievance about it all.
And then how did you make that turn to starting so many different things? You were going around the world, as you know, monitoring elections, Habitat for Humanity, building houses. Rosalind was doing all kinds of things on mental health and caregiving. I mean, you really kind of kicked it up.
Yeah, well, all that didn't happen at once. All that, I'd say everything you mentioned happened within a year. But we were both here in Plains just taking care of moving the presidential library down to Atlanta and that sort of thing and starting up the Carter Center without knowing what it was going to do. My first vision of the Carter Center was just to have a miniature Camp David where people that had an ongoing war or potential conflict would come to me, and I would either let them come to Atlanta and I would negotiate with them, or I'd go to their country and negotiate. And that was the first vision of the Carter Center. And then we went from there to elections and then massive health programs, including mental health. So all of that kind of grew out of it. And we didn't know about Habitat for Humanity when I was still in the White House. We only found out about it. Their international headquarters happened to be just 9 miles from Plains. So we got involved in Habitat, and we got re-involved in our church.
Jimmy and Rosalind Carter helped transform the Habitat for Humanity. For 35 years, they've gotten out there themselves with hammers and paintbrushes to lead an annual week-long construction project. Their participation has brought in 100,000-plus volunteers to build 4,000-plus homes for the poor. Certainly, much of their commitment to the poor comes from their Christian faith and from the example of friends like Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Kofi Annan, and Mother Teresa. But some of it, Jimmy Carter said in the 1991 interview with Jim Angle, can also be traced back to a book.
Obviously, in a community where I live, the Bible was the center of people's reading. But when people ask me what's a favorite book that I've ever read, I usually say Let Us Now Praise Famous Men by James Agee, who went into a little remote area in Alabama during the Depression years, got a grant from the WPA or something, and he wrote about the lives of people who lived in desperate poverty and how they dealt with the exigencies of life, the challenges and disappointments of life, and still had a coherent family. We still have people like that living in our country. And what impressed me with that book was a tremendous chasm that was not crossed between people who have everything, who have a house and job and education and adequate diets and a sense of success or security, who want to do good things, and the vast array of people still in our country who don't have any of these things and whom we seldom, if ever, know. I experienced the ravages of racial discrimination as a child and even as an adult. And I've seen discrimination against women and wars all over the world because of ethnic discrimination. The greatest discrimination in the world now, here in Atlanta, in New York, is a discrimination against poor people. We don't even know them. We care in general about homelessness or drug addiction or school dropouts, but we don't know a homeless person, and we don't know a drug addict, and we don't know a school dropout or a teenage pregnant woman. And this is not a deliberate discrimination. It's a discrimination by default, because we tend to build a plastic bubble around ourselves so that we only have to associate with people just like us. And so this suffering that still goes on in our country and around the world is very severe. And that book, among other things, just kind of woke me up to the fact that we still have, you know, people like this next door. We're not doing much about it.
In the 28 years since that interview, Jimmy Carter has never stopped trying to do something about it. And it is a long list, including the near eradication of guinea worm disease across Africa and a partnership with four other former presidents to help the recovery efforts following Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria.
You've had unusual scope of all the work you've done, from working on a single house for a single family to Middle East peace. What would you like people, when they talk about your legacy, what would you like them to say?
Well, if I just mentioned two things, I would say peace and human rights. I tried to promote human rights in every way I could, and the Carter Center still does that. And I look upon the right to live in peace to be preeminent among all the human rights. You can't have other elements of human rights if you're living in a war zone. And I see the deleterious effect in our own country of constantly being at war. I looked up on Google the other morning in preparation for my Sunday school class, and I noticed that the United States has been a country now for about 242 years. Only 16 of those years have we been totally at peace. 16 out of 242 years we've been at peace. The rest of the time we've been in conflict with somebody. And so that has taken a tremendous amount of our wealth and income and potentiality from doing what's just best for our people.
And so many people remember when you were diagnosed with cancer.
Yes, I do too.
And it was bad, brain cancer.
And liver cancer.
And liver cancer.
Yeah.
And you said, I'm perfectly at ease with whatever comes next.
Yeah, I was.
Did you think you were going to die then?
Yes, I thought I was going to die in just a few weeks. Because I had already had a good portion of my liver removed that had cancer. And they had just found four places in my brain that had four spots in my brain that had cancer. And all of their prognoses of the doctors was that I was had a very short time to live. So we came home and were pretty well reconciled. We told our family, we told the Carter Center folks, and everybody thought it along with me. So I was prepared to die.
What was Rosalind's reaction to that?
Just grief-stricken, but I think I tried to assuage her grief to some degree by pointing out what a wonderful life both of us had had. At that time, we had been married 69 years, very happily, and we had a good life in Plains. We had a good life at the Carter Center. We had a good life in politics. Had a good life, you know, in education. So we couldn't have had a better life. My family was wonderful. So everything about it had been a very successful and glorious life.
It's been 4 years since that cancer diagnosis, and Jimmy Carter continues to make the most of his time on this earth, working for all he believes in, and cooking a pancake breakfast with Rosalind every Sunday. She has syrup, he prefers honey, and his homemade yogurt. They also still enjoy fly fishing and bird watching. Their combined list includes 1,300 birds. And whenever their friend Willie Nelson comes through Georgia, you're likely to find the rock and roll president and his wife of 73 years on stage, joining in on a rousing Amazing Grace.
When we
the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. When he won the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize, by the way, Willie Nelson also invited him to the stage in Oslo, Norway, to sing Georgia on My Mind. President Carter was interviewed in Georgia by the Academy of Achievement in 1991 by television journalist Jim Angle, and in 2017 and 2019 by Mary Jordan, who by day is a political correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for joining us for our 100th episode.
That's about as good as it is.